On this episode of Skeptico,
there's all these idiosyncrasies to the tradition that he has this deep knowledge of, that it is just impossible to believe that this guy from Kent just, you know, rolls out of bed.
He couldn't have known it. It took me 30 years of research before I finally got it right. And a lot of coincidences concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls, everything. It couldn't have come out of his head.
I think that's one of the things that people have a hard time, especially me, have a hard time wrapping my head around. What the heck is Stephen doing coming back writing books?
Stephen's message is very similar to that of the Franciscans. The higher we go, the more we are each other. The lower we go, the more separate we are.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. You know, I've been wanting to do a show about channeling for quite some time because between this crazy scientific atheism, I wouldn't believe it even if it was true kind of mindset, and the gullible, I'll believe anything as long as I don't have to think too hard and it doesn't conflict with my existing beliefs. Between those two, there's a huge amount of, and the gullible, I'll believe anything as long as it fits in with my existing beliefs. There's this huge amount of stuff out there that claims to be channeled material from ascended beings, whatever that means, that purports to communicate the real truth. So when Michael Cox, an 88-year-old Anglican priest from New Zealand, contacted me about his book, Afterlife Teachings from Stephen the Martyr, I thought, wow, here's a great opportunity. I'm not sure that Stephen the Martyr is even a real being, and that he's channeled this book for this guy. Great stuff. I want to talk to him. So I did. And I have to tell you, and you'll hear this, I mean, I kind of hit him with everything I got. I asked all the questions that I wanted to ask about channel material, why we should believe it, what he did to verify whether he was really having communication with this historical figure from 2,000 years ago, and how he went about verifying that, which turns out to be quite amazing. I mean, he really did the kind of research that you would expect a historian or a biblical scholar to do to find out if there's any thing to it, so gotta give him kudos for that. And I also asked him about a bunch of other strange things, synchronicities, and other pretty amazing things that happened surrounding this whole experience that he had for 40 years. 40-year experience he's gonna talk about. Now, the one thing I have to alert you to, this interview, it doesn't start in the normal way. I called him up just to kind of do a pre-interview, and we wound up rolling into the real interview. You can figure it out. It's not that hard. It's an Anglican priest from New Zealand who wrote a book on channeling, and I start talking to him about whether we should even have an interview. You'll catch on really quickly. Here's my interview with Michael Cox.
I'm driven. I've been driven to prove religion by scientific research and experience since I was about five. So I wondered whether you were a similar driven person.
Yeah, I think to me, to me, that's backwards. We can't be driven to prove something. We have to work from the data and work up and see what it proves. And that's one of the issues I have with some of the work that comes from this whole vein. You know, I interviewed a guy not too long ago. I've done a tremendous amount of research into the near-death experience.
Right.
Which I think is the most important research in proving, one, the craziness of the scientific materialism that has just blinded people, and also is...
Absolutely.
And hidden people from God. I mean, let's face it. I mean, this is what the after-death communication research, I think, has to say, is God. It says God, God, God. There's no getting away
from God everywhere.
That's it.
We're part of God.
Exactly. You can't get away from it. You can't dance around it. You can't qualify it and say it's quantum or this or that. It's just there. That's your count. But, so the guy I interview is... as a guy who's a really Christian guy. And he came on the show and he had a very Christian interpretation of his, this guy's name is Ian McCormick. And he came out and he had a very Christian interpretation of his near-death experience. And I totally accept that when he died, he went and saw Jesus and he put Christ consciousness, right? He didn't see Jesus because Jesus we refer to as someone who lived, right? If you believe that Jesus lived. But he saw a being that said, here, put your hand in my hand, you know, that, and gave him the experience of Jesus. I accept that. But I don't accept that as proof of a historical Jesus. I accept it as part of a body of after-death communication that makes it clear that our consciousness is more, that God exists, that there is this great mystery that we're a part of. So that's the issue and the problem, I guess, I have that I thought we should have this chat and talk about, because I don't do interviews where I talk to people and I go, oh, wow, isn't that great? I'm like to have more of a dialogue and a conversation like this.
That's what I want.
Okay, great.
I'm dedicated to, I'm a clergyman. I've been a priest for 63 years. I'm an old man now. you mightn't believe it when you look at me. However, I've had enough experience to sink a ship, and the experience tells me that we're all participants in this in one mind. When the Pope said there are two doctrines, love God and love neighbor and nothing else, I was very pleased. And also, Christ's message for me is love of God, love of neighbor. We are part of each other. There's no distinction of race or belief. Comes into this story of the Good Samaritan. Salvation does not, for me, consist of the blood of Christ or anything like that. It consists of coming to God, like the prodigal son. I think Jesus' teaching was very simple. And we've got, in our house, we've got a Brahmin Indian living with us. And he came to us on the other, and he said to me, I'm not an Indian. I'm not a Brahmin. I'm a human being. And that is a good thing to say.
How do you reconcile that then with church doctrine, church dogma? I mean, as I shared with you in the shows that I did, why do we need Christianity then? What does Christianity add to that equation? Because the message that you're talking about, the wisdom that you're bringing, is shared across virtually every culture, every wisdom tradition. There is nothing special about Christianity with regard to that message. It's not unique. It's not special. It's not different. Why do we need Christianity? And why do people use this important scientific finding of after-death communication as a way to prop up and somehow raise up Christianity above anything else? So if you want to say Christianity is another jumping off point into the pool, no one has any problem with that. But that's never really been the message. The message has always been subtly that it is somehow special, unique, different, better.
Right. My mentor, Stephen, you've read about, said the pursuit of Christ is the pursuit of this consciousness, whether you call it Christian, yellow, green, or whatever you like to call it.
Right.
And it's the same pursuit as the higher forms of Hinduism, Buddhism do. They're all seeking what it means to be, feel yourself part of the universal mind or spirit. So I defend Christians in this way and say that we're all different people with different points of view. And in my liberal Anglican church or Episcopalian church, we've got Hindus and Buddhists and we're all worshipping together, but we're worshipping together as people, learning love of God and love of neighbor. And yes, some of the Christian hymns are very, very good. and exactly as we'd be saying. And some parts of the Bible are very, very good indeed. That's what I've been preaching about the last 63 years, the good bits. But on the other hand, I do recognize, as Jesus himself said, we're all children of God, including the Muslims and the atheists and whoever you care to name. We're all children of God. We're all connected to each other. My experiences have been very largely with major synchronicities. I'd previously had a major synchronicity with a professor called Stephen Rosen, who was professor of psychology in Staten Island. He's now a philosopher in Vancouver. Years ago, I've been reading Fritjof Capra. Fritjof Capra mentioned the physicist David Bohm, and I was very impressed with what he was saying. David Bohm is a way of explaining my experiences. So I got off my bed. I was reading in bed, and I went to the entrance of my country vicarage where the post box stands. In the post box was a book from Stephen Rosen of Staten Island. And then the next thing he had was acknowledgements. I want to express my deep thanks to David Bohm, Arthur C. Clarke, and Michael Cox. There was my name written under the name of Bohm 5 minutes after I heard about him. Now, I've had so much of that, but it's forced me to see life in a very different way.
Michael, as long as you brought up that story, let me ask the obvious question. What do you make of, how do you interpret in general the idea of a synchronicity? Because this is something that has come into the collective consciousness. We hear it more and more and more, people talking about 11-11 and seeing things, or just more personal synchronicities that they have. Do you have any personal insight into what you think the meaning of synchronicities are in general? Not your personal synchronicity, but why do people have synchronicity?
I've written a book on that, Into the Wider Dream, trying to answer that. The short answer is I don't know. A longer answer would be to say that the spiritual whole, undivided whole, is a little like a spiritual internet. Everything is in touch with everything else. John Bell of CERN in Switzerland talks about universal causation, no local causation. Everything causes everything else.
Well, let me just interject something, Michael, because I appreciate where you're going, and I think it's fascinating. But I have to tell you, when you make the association with the internet and the connection, there is a group of people out there that are taking that in another direction. And they're taking everything you said, and they're saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they're taking a spiritual component out of it, and they're substituting in an artificial intelligence component, a biological component, and it's called the simulation hypothesis.
They're crazy.
I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but I think you're in a unique position to kind of connect, cross over that bridge in a way that maybe I think is necessary. And that's that, how do we come to understand the nature of the spiritual when it does seem to pop up in ways that are almost intentionally disguised as the artificial, the simulated, the automated, computerized, if you know what I mean?
Okay, the whole damn thing belongs together. Spiritual, physical, it all belongs together. There's rubbish and otherwise, but we're dealing with an unbroken whole. Science says that. Experience says that. It's an unbroken whole. I have to say that I think that you and I are living in a kind of a film that's projected from another level. My Stephen said we are eternal beings, all of us, but we are having experiences in the body for a reason. So we're like children looking at our reflections in a pool of water and in our imaginations in the pool with the reflections, but we're not really. We're actually eternal beings with limited consciousness now, to keep our eyes, noses to the grindstone of having our experiences. Synchronicity to me confirms we're in this film.
Interesting. Let's dig into that a little bit. This is a good dialogue. One, my feeling is that these kind of metaphors are problematic, and that whenever we fall into those, we just stumble all over ourselves. My sense, and I can't support this with scientific evidence, is that God is just so much bigger than we can ever describe or imagine inside of our container that we're in, that it's almost nonsensical to start putting our analogies on them. It's like an internet. It's like a telephone. It's like a big clock. None of that stuff works because I get the sense that it's much, much, much grander than we can even imagine.
But I'm clapping you.
Thanks. But the other part that I guess still intrigues me and drives me forward is that I also don't really feel comfortable with the idea that we are children, we are actors down here, and there's this one dimension and there's this other dimension. Because again, the information that I seem to be taking back out of this research suggests that there are, again, probably so many more dimensions than we can even imagine. And I'll give you a couple examples. Like people say, we're here, we're sent down here to learn a lesson, this and that. And that's somewhat confirmed through the near-death experience research when people die and they go to this other realm and they sometimes face a decision. They say, oh, I really want to go back. I have to take care of my kids. And they're actually given a choice and they're given the ability to go back or not go back. This kind of contradicts the idea that, you know, we are just down here for a lesson, everything is planned out, or that these two realms, at least these two that we're talking about here, are really separate, because clearly these realms are interacting. But let me give you another example that I think really intrigues me as well, and it's rarely ever talked about in this realm. One of the first aspects of the paranormal that got me interested in this from a very practical sense was the idea of a psychic detective, because I saw these TV shows and I said, gee, I don't know a lot about police work, but I know if you get a hardened 20-year homicide detective, that's not someone you're just going to go in and tell a story to and he's going to fall for it. So the fact that these psychics were able to connect with people who had passed away and said, hey, I have information to get you about solving this case, I found intriguing. And I followed it up quite extensively and found that there was just no doubt that that's true. But here's the angle, Michael. Here's the angle that really intrigues me that I don't hear people talking about. This is not a mission of love, per se. This is much more of a human kind of mission. A mission of, yes, I must avenge my death. Justice must be done. You know, find the killer kind of thing. It to me plays out as above, so below, that this extended dimension, at least some of these extended dimensions that we're talking about here, are really much like ours. And I think sometimes when we talk about them, we talk about them like they are so much different than ours, of which I'm sure there are, but maybe there's so many of them we can't even imagine, but some of them seem to be a lot like ours. What do you think about that?
Evidence from spiritualism and so on is we take ourselves into the next world, for better or worse, and our opinions and personalities. So there are many sides to the spiritual world which we don't understand. I asked Stephen, what is God? He said, everything that you see and experience that you cannot see and don't know and don't understand, he's infinitely more than we can understand. So I'm agreeing with what you say further back.
Let's talk about channeling, because that's really, I jumped right into the middle of this conversation. Michael, I thought that we would just have a chat, you know, before an interview, but I think this is turning into the interview, so we'll just kind of wing it from here, and I'll do a proper introduction early on or maybe at the end, and then I'll paste it back at the beginning so that people can pick up on this conversation. But there's a lot of good things here to talk about. Channeling intrigues me, and let me just ask some really basic questions about your experience. And the first one would be, what do you think is happening when you talk to Stephen? And you know what? I got to scratch that question. First, you're going to have to tell people, what is your experience with channeling? Who is this being, this entity, Stephen? How did he come about? Tell us the basic story, I guess.
It may be too long for this interview.
Go ahead.
It starts off a Catholic lady called Olive Ashman in bed with her husband Tom. And Tom has not previously been a medium, but talking, he starts to talk in his sleep. And the Olive hears a voice say, "Sic ecclesia spiritus sanctus." Thus in the church is the Holy Spirit. And she found that Tom was able to go into trance, and the spirit continued to talk and identified him with Stephen. That is in Sevenoaks in Kent. I, here in New Zealand, on that, about that same day, received a book of prophecies from a lady I didn't know called Mrs. Copinger from Te Puke in North Island about me and what was about to happen to me.
Okay, so let me get this straight. First of all, what year is this about?
1973.
Okay, so this is 1973. So now that's what, 44 years ago. And
yep.
It later you discover, you just get the book of prophecies. You don't know anything about this other experience going on in Kent, but later you find that it happened at exactly the same time.
That's right. The 3 months later, Olive and Tom Ashman are here in Christchurch, New Zealand. And by a curious coincidence, I met them and they invited me to talk to Stephen. So I joined them and had several other people talking.
Wait a minute. So at this point, they had established communication with this spirit entity, and they understood that spirit entity to be Stephen at that point?
They did.
And who is Stephen? Tell folks who Stephen is and how they knew it was Stephen.
Stephen was the first Christian martyr, and he said to Olive who he was, and they believed it. I didn't initially believe it when I taught. It took a little while to trust him, but his speech was humble, loving, and giving us basic Christianity, but also trying to tell us about the nature of reality, which is very close to the point of view of reality being put forward by Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R, who is a Franciscan monk who is favored by the Pope. So it's been confirming to me recently that Stephen's message and Rohr's message are very similar.
Okay, these folks make contact with the spirit entity in 1973, the same day you get this book of prophecies. By some strange coincidence, they come to Christchurch, New Zealand. They meet you. You're an Anglican priest. They start talking to you. They say, "We've had this amazing experience. We want you to share it with us. We're talking to Stephen. Join in this experience of ours." Am I got that right?
Yep. Now, after about maybe a year, I still, it's a bit of a thing to swallow. I'm actually talking to Stephen. I recognized how good the teaching was, but was it actually Stephen? In fact, someone suggested it was a kindly spirit masquerading as Stephen. Well, I wanted to test Stephen in a language other than English.
You say you wanted to test Stephen?
Yes, I wasn't quite sure how much of the mind of the medium was in this.
Right, right. So you wanted to test. That's good. I like it. Yeah.
I did. And he said, the next time Stephen said, "Carno dioti, dieta dioti, carno dioti, borro, zilla lenicamela diesta." You probably can't translate that, but it means "for the carnix," symbol for the kilt.
And what language would that be in?
The language of common Greek, about the beginning of the time of Jesus' life. It is the dialect, however, it turned out, that is spoken in Bulgaria, modern, then called Thrace, and in the area of Turkey around Ankara.
And folks will naturally be interested to know how did you confirm that precise dialect, you know, identify it and trace it?
It took a long while.
And did you have a recording of it? Or?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh. I had a recording and transliterated it.
So they're coming through this woman's husband, and he's speaking it in a clear enough way for you to record it and then for some expert to give you an analysis of it. That's pretty amazing.
Yes, I know the Greek of that time. That's how I was able to translate it. But he used the word endings were anomalous. I found that he used a word peculiar to the native Thracian language, which actually has never been written, except that a Greek grammarian had recorded it. The word zillai, which meant wine. Then the complicated references, and so turned out what he was saying was the words he had used speaking to Joseph, the parent of Jesus, as he entered an Essene camp in Galilee, and the camp was called the Nazarene sect of the Essenes, and he spoke it on the occasion that he'd had 2 years novitiate or probation, and he was about to be entered, received into the Essenes. And from the Dead Sea Scrolls, I was able to discover that to enter the Essenes, you had to have a messianic communion service in which you diluted grape juice with water, because the Greek here was to do about the necessity of diluting this grape juice. It made no sense. It took me about 30 years to work it all out.
So the big picture story, you begin these dialogues, you have to be intrigued, overwhelmed, you're skeptical, you know, or curious, like you said, you want to check things out, you want to test things, but I'm taking it that the more and more you get into it, you're like, I have to collect this information, and then I have to do what with it? What was your first thought when you started doing this, and then how did it go? I mean, how many sessions did you have? How often did you have them? What did you do with the material? And what were your thoughts when this stuff started coming through? This is a long period of time. This is 43 years. Were there phases? I mean, what was it like at the beginning? What was it like at the middle? You know, all that stuff.
Difficult question. We were always on a high when we were talking to him. We got a little dispirited that he was giving such good advice, such good teaching. We found ourselves not quite able to live up to it. And people in our group were getting divorced, and we're carrying on being normal human beings, I'm sorry to say. But the teaching continued.
Do they go back to Kent, or how does it continue? Did they move to Christ Church?
No, they stayed here.
And you formed a little group, and then how often would you meet, and what would be the nature of these meetings? How long would the sessions go? What would you do with them? How did that hold?
We had 200 sessions. And I'll show you my book. The group the teaching stopped in 1981, another session in 1993, and then that was over. But we had all the synchronicity. We'd be given object lessons as to what life and spirit meant. So the continual coincidences. We had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. In fact, before I talked to Stephen, I was experiencing all these coincidences, and I'd got acceptance from the University of Melbourne to write a Doctorate of Divinity thesis on coincidence. I never did it because although I had a huge amount of data, Stephen turned up. And so we talked to Stephen all this time.
But before I get into more of the scientific stuff, which is really just not that important and interesting in one sense. In another sense, it's what we all want to, in our logical, rational mind, want to pull apart. And I want to do that pulling apart because I think that's helpful, especially for us men. A lot of times what we need to deconstruct it and understand it logically before we can feel it spiritually and emotionally. At least I'm like that, and I think a lot of other people are like that. But let's put that aside, because what I want to know is, you are a man of God. You've been on that path for a long time. How did this information hit you spiritually? How did it make you feel? Did it challenge any of your existing beliefs? It certainly had to challenge some of your quote-unquote religious beliefs. What was that experience, the spiritual experience, like for you encountering this information?
I've always been a liberal, and I went to a modernist college at Oxford, a theological college, and so I always prepared to question. It didn't question my basic belief in love of God and love of neighbor. I've always been a generalist. I've always been prepared to say that people of other religions are like me, and they've got equal access to whatever God is that I have. I did a degree in philosophy and psychology, and my problem has been thinking, because most of it, all the stuff is feeling, actually. And so it took me a long time not to intellectualize so much. I'm afraid it's taken to my 80s before I finally gave away being clever.
That's awesome. When you encountered Stephen then, how did it change you spiritually? Was it a slow change, an instant change? Did you fall on your knees and cry? What was it like? I've done that before. I mean, I'll admit it. You know, I've had spiritual experiences that have drawn me to that. I mean, what was it like for you?
Well, I can, before I met Stephen, this is an example of how he affected me. I'm a member of a group called Sobud, which is a mystical Islamic group where they offer you the chance to meet God as without benefit of Bible or clergy. And that attracted me, that idea. And in the end, I found myself falling in a crying heap because I'd given away something or another and I felt I was dying. I didn't die, of course, but that's what it felt like at the moment. After that, the very same night, obviously still very much alive, I went to listen to a string quartet. And I spoiled the whole evening by being envious about the skill of these people were playing their music. And I said, don't be such a stupid person, Michael. You're spoiling a spiritual experience by your envy. Okay, well, that's obvious. You think it's obvious too. But I went home into my study and I had a voice said to me, I should crawl on my belly under and look under a certain bookcase over there. I'd find a book and I was to open it, page 73. So I did what the voice said. I found the book and the poem in question read, Ode for Music by Thomas Gray. I'm a fool at remembering actual words, but the gist was, don't spoil a spiritual experience by envying the musicians. Well, I knew that in the first place, but do you see what that taught me? My mind is not here in my head. My mind is much wider than that. But I told you that story because that's just the general, gist of what Stephen was saying. We are all each other. We're all connected to each other. And our job is to acknowledge this and feel it.
Okay. So now we're going to do the other part of it, the intellectual part of it, the part of it that you've sworn off of and I'm trying to wean myself off of, but we still have to indulge in a little bit. What do you think is happening during the channeling process? What is your best guess in terms of if you were going to break that down? You know, so we had an interesting conversation, and I'm glad we did before this, about talking about the psychic who's connecting with the person who was murdered, and that person's agenda or that spirit's agenda is vengeance and justice. We talk about the other mother who dies and meets her mother, and her mother holds her and loves her and says, yes, honey, but it's not your time. You should go back to your body. And it's purely a love experience.
I believe all that.
What is your best guess in terms of what's happening here? Because this is of a different nature. This is I think that's one of the things that people have a hard time, especially me, have a hard time wrapping my head around. What the heck is Stephen doing coming back writing books?
I do. I can say that Stephen's message is very similar to that of the Franciscans, Franciscan theology. It's down to earth for every day. However, it's not really every day because there are levels of love, levels of spirituality to which we can send. The higher we go, the more we are each other. The lower we go, the more separate we are. And Stephen says he no longer inhabits the tent of personality of Stephen. He is a much more wider consciousness than that. But to talk to us so we don't feel frightened, he comes back to the tent of his familiar tent and talks from that point of view.
Let me interject that. I didn't really phrase my question very well. I'll kind of approach it from a different angle. Michael, I've interviewed a lot of channelers, not a lot, but I've interviewed several channelers on this show. I interviewed one who claimed to channel Thomas. And was clearly a fraud. He was proven to me a fraud and to be his channeled material was verbatim of a poor translation of the Book of Thomas. And he didn't even do a good job of it. He had picked one of the wrong translations to do. So we have that. We also have people who maybe are doing real channeling, but their personal lives do not hold up to scrutiny. You know, the whole What the Bleep Do We Know film was based on the channeled material. Not the whole film wasn't based on it, but the person behind it was this woman, Jay-Z Knight, who claimed to be channeling this 35,000-year-old warrior spirit Ra. And maybe she was or maybe she wasn't, but she wound up also getting involved in all this kind of nefarious stuff of making money and selling horses and saying this horse is a reincarnation of this and that. So there's the hucksters, they're the fraudsters, but then there's a lot of people in between that are getting material that, when it's scrutinized, doesn't hold up to scrutiny in the way that we would expect. So how are we to understand the channeled material in that context? One way of asking that that's kind of maybe the direct way is, why is God letting this go on? Why is God letting all sorts of channeled material come through, some of which is clearly false, some of which is delusional, and some of which is probably, as you've investigated the best you can, as best you can determine, is genuine. What's going on?
I don't think there's quite a head office in control. I think together we are God. Some spirits are, and some are not. St. John said, test the spirits. I think Stephen teaching on its own is self-validating, but I got a couple of professors to test my Greek research, and they said it couldn't have been forged.
At this point, do you believe that the material you've gotten back is historical?
Some of it, because I questioned Stephen about his dialect, and I said, my first thought, he must have come from Thrace, for the reason I've said. But I said, no, he was born on the banks of the Ankara River, on the other side of the river from ancient Ankara, or modern Ankara. He lived, he said, in a village called Seletar. And I said, yes, what's the name mean? Fourth landing place, he said. And then when I looked that up in the Little and Scots Greek lexicon, I found, well, tar, T-A-R, in some Greek dialects can mean fourth, and celia is a kind of a tray. So it would be feasible that Seletar would mean fourth landing place. That's one thing. When referring to the Essenes, spoke Hebrew or Aramaic, and they had... In the Aramaic language, they had a grape juice festival given a Hebrew name, which I've just forgotten for the moment. Stephen, talking in Greek, referred to the Athenian grape juice festival. And the grape juice festival had to do with the dilution of the grape juice.
So there's two different kinds of grape juice festivals.
Both cultures had their grape juice festivals.
Uh-huh. But the one had this specific, unique thing where they dilute the wine, and...
I haven't quite said that. In the service, in the Messianic communion service that the Essenes held, they diluted the grape juice with water. Stephen referred to the Athens equivalent.
Uh-huh.
Speaking in Greek.
Uh-huh. I kind of see what you mean. So, again, the point is there's all these idiosyncrasies to the tradition that of the time that he has this deep knowledge of that it is just impossible to believe that this guy from Kent just, you know, rolls out of bed. That's just impossible to...
It took me 30 years of research before I finally got it right. A lot of coincidences. Consulted the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes.
Everything.
Right.
Couldn't have come out of his head. He invited to be checked. One time he's talking to us. Tom, the medium, went into trance with his feet dangling from a high chair. And so Stephen comes on air and says, "Yea, verily, I perceive that I must be a saint. I see my feet are in the air."
So a little bit of a sense of humor, huh?
Well, he certainly did have one, yes.
Again, the question I've asked it a couple of times, but I have to ask it again. What is this telling you about the nature of that other realm that Stephen occupies, number one? And what does it tell you about the nature of the interaction between that realm and our realm? Because here's a guy, he's playing around. He says he's kind of transcended beyond this, but he'll come down to this level, embody this spirit level that then he can interact. And then he interacts in a playful way. I mean, there's a lot of subtle messages beyond the big picture message of love everyone, tell the truth. There's another message about the nature of these realms and how they're interacting that I find interesting and I think a lot of people find interesting.
It's very hard to characterize. One of the things he says is that we asked him one time, why did the murderer kill Kennedy? And so Stephen said, I shall have to become the murderer to find out. So in a sense, it's very hard to define who we are in the next life.
There's a lot of folks out there that have concerns about channeled information, about mediumistic information, and about whether it's dangerous, whether it comes to them either spontaneously or whether they seek it out. And we know, or we have suspicion, that there are spirits out there that are not interested in our well-being. Do you have any insight into that? Any words of caution? Or do you think we don't really have to worry?
I do think we have to worry. We should, as St. John said in his epistle, test the spirits.
Okay, really practically, what do you mean when you say that? How would you test a spirit?
Well, our test for Stephen was, first of all, we prayed for protection. We did always pray for that. But Stephen is consistently humble and loving and sensible, so he kind of validated himself. So the accompanying synchronicity seemed to do that.
I see where the synchronicities would be confirming, but I'm intrigued by this idea of testing him. Other than just testing that he was consistently humble and sending messages that you felt were consistent with goodness as you knew it, were there any other tests that you did that you would pass along to people as ways to kind of determine if you're talking to a good spirit?
I can't think of a rule. But about lack of human relationships, you have to be very cautious. I'm talking to you because I feel in sympathy with you and feel with you. But if you'd come on different, might have been less at ease.
Have you heard of the trickster as a possible explanation? You have?
Yes, I have. I have, yes.
What do you make of that? Because there is a certain playful element in this that seems to be a little bit beyond what we normally think of when we think about pious spiritual training. I mean, there's a playful part of this that is...
Stephen is playful.
Why, though? Why be playful? Why?
That's how we experience love. Mm. We play the fool.
Michael, it's great work. Tell us what's going on with the book. Tell us about the ground of faith. And tell us about what's going on with you right now.
Well, what's going on with me right now is I'm getting older. but I can still talk.
Okay, you're getting older. Does that mean you're feeling a compulsion to kind of get this information out in a new way? Well, tell us about the ground of faith.
That's the reason I do have a compulsion, because I think Stephen's important. The ground of faith was a journal that I founded 14 years ago, and it's got a fairly wide readership. Most readers in the States, the Ukraine, surprisingly, France and Germany, to some degree in England and Australia and New Zealand. And I'm trying to draw attention to all the main people about psychical research.
Why is the psychical research important to you? Because, you know, we started this conversation and we kind of went along that line. And then at one point, I like that you just kind of, when we went down there too far and talked about the simulation, you said it's just rubbish. It's just a bunch of crap. I sometimes feel like when we go down the psychical research angle, down that path, we have to go there because some people are drawn to that. But on another hand, we know it's bullshit. It's just bullshit. It's distraction. I mean, the spirit is where it's at. The spiritual is where it's at.
Exactly.
So what use is the psychical research? Why do we go there?
Well, I'm not a wonderful psychic. I have psychical moments. But some people, some communicators are great and good and worthy of listening to. All the stuff published by White Crow Books.
Oh, I've interviewed him, and I've also interviewed a couple other people from White Crow Books.
Michael Timms' stories, I think, are very well worth while telling.
Absolutely. And that's an important part of history as well. It's history, right?
Important part of history. I don't quarrel with a bit of what he's doing, but I'm a clergyman. I am religious in my own way. And I recognize religion as the feeling of unity between people. And the good thing, shorn of all the doctrine, the Christian idea of the communion service is good because we're having communion with each other, with the rest of the world, and feeling our oneness. We also have rubbish, but there's nobody except the churches kind of do that, preserve the community and the togetherness. So I think that's the point of churches, human and fallible as they certainly are.
Michael, final question. Why do you think Stephen, St. Stephen the Martyr, why did Stephen come through to you at this time?
I think we're the similar type.
You and Stephen? Uh-huh.
We belong to the same kind of group.
The book is available, obviously, through all the regular places.
Through Amazon, usually.
Through Amazon. But then the ground of faith is kind of turning over and going to be, you're kind of changing that to be more directed principally towards...
More towards Stephen.
More towards Stephen. Just kind of coming out with it and saying, hey, this is really my life's work. This is what we need to kind of push forward with.
I'm being a bit more aggressive about it. Well, it's been very great to meet you. It's been a great pleasure.
Mine as well, Michael. I appreciate it. And I like, you know, I have hard interviews and I like to kind of push people pretty hard. And you're just like, you're too good. You're too solid. You're rock solid. There's nothing we can do. We can't upset you. Tremendous talking to you. And I will try and edit this into something that sounds reasonable. And I will certainly send it to you so you have a link to the show when we put it up.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Michael Cox for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, it was kind of a hassle putting this interview together because, I don't know, I had to do a lot of editing on it. And I wound up listening to parts over and over again. But as I did, I was more and more impressed by some of the deep messages that Michael has brought forward in this book. Whether you think they came from Stephen or not, there's some pretty profound spiritual truths in here that I think are quite amazing. So the one question I'd have to tee up from this interview is, what are the pitfalls and opportunities regarding channeled material, and to what extent has Michael distinguished himself above the crowd and delivered to us something significant here? Love to hear your thoughts on that. You can contact me through the Skeptico forum or through the Skeptico website at SKEPTIKO. You can also reach me on Facebook and all the other usual places. Hey, I have a number of great shows coming up and a bunch more interviews in the hopper. I can't seem to curb my passion for talking to all these really cool, interesting people. So I'm looking forward to bringing that all to you. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.